Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is Lawrence Dudley. And Lawrence wrote a book about the 1940 presidential election where the Germans interfered with our elections. And, you know, then he's going to talk about the elections today. So basically, give us an overview of the 1940 election and why it's important today.
Well, Cynthia, first, thank you for having me on your show again. And I'm really honored to be your 1,000th guest. That's congratulations
yes,
for doing this and keeping it going. You're a great community resource here, and I thank you and compliment you on all of this. Congratulate you. So, yes, my book, New York Station, it's partially actually based in the Capital District in Saratoga Springs, but it's based on true stories. The first is that the Germans really did try to intervene in the 1940 presidential election. It was a really major, serious effort. They sent over at one point about $5 million to fund this effort. That was an enormous sum in 1940, coming right out of the Depression. People were still, you know, pretty down on their luck in a lot of ways. And to give you a sense of that, a brand new Spitfire fighter plane, which was the best fighter plane in the world at the time, cost about $52,000. So it would have bought almost 100 Spitfire fighter planes. By comparison, the entire budget for 1939 of the British Secret Intelligence Service was only £750,000. So that's about maybe $1.5 million or $2 million, or somewhere around in there. Maybe a little bit more, about $3 million actually, I think. So this was a really serious effort. At one point, we know for a fact that the Nazis tried to bribe and successfully bribed the Pennsylvania delegation to the Democratic National Convention to not vote for Roosevelt. They paid him about $4,000 apiece, and it was $160,000 in total, and there were 39 delegates. So that was like around $4,000 a delegate. That would have bought a really nice house in that day and age in a place like Loudonville. It was a lot of money. A new Packard cost about $1,100. So that gives you a sense of what it meant. They were really serious about it.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
We were not in the war yet.
No. The United States, the isolationists and the United States were very powerful at the time. They really wanted to keep us out of the war. Roosevelt was inclined to help the British. He didn't necessarily want to get the United States into the war, but he really wanted to help Britain. And but he was blocked on doing that. It was a very, very scary time. You had people like Charles Lindbergh, who was became a friend of Hermann Goering over there in the 1930s. Basically chummed up with the Nazis, and you had him going around the country attacking Roosevelt and demanding isolation and so on. So it was a very dangerous time. The British had lost the Battle of Britain. We would have been completely isolated here in the Western Hemisphere, and it's questionable whether even the United States could have survived as a country, as an independent country, to be accurate. So that was a very scary time. It was probably the narrowest passageway through which democracy ever passed since the Athenians took to the ships, basically, thousands of years ago. So a lot was at stake. And the character in the story is sent over from Britain. He's half American and half English to try and disrupt this plot. And much of the action takes place in Saratoga Springs. So it has a strong local element, too, at the time.
Mm-hmm. So bring us up to today from what you surmised from 1940. How bad is the Russian interference in the election? Well, you know, they said 2016 and 18. How bad is it going to be from your perspective in 2020?
I think it's going to be very bad, and we're getting warning from all kinds of people in the intelligence community. They expect a full-scale attack again. Brennan, the former CIA director, just basically recently warned that this is greatly dangerous. I think the intelligence community is kind of chafing under Trump. They want to do more and they want to say more, but I think they're being blocked by this. And there are a lot of this really kind of scary things going on. for instance, there's a bill tied up in the Senate by a man they're calling Moscow Mitch now to secure our elections and make sure we have paper ballots and so on so that we know what happened with a lot of these election machines. And it's they're blocking it. And why? So I think it's a very scary time. I think the Russians clearly intervened in the last election, two elections. Probably wasn't quite so serious 2018, but it was very serious in 2016. I think in many ways it was probably successful. And it isn't, I don't think it was just limited to social media and information attacks, like hacking emails and releasing them. I mean, clearly they wanted to sabotage some campaigns and promote some other ones. But I think I do think it had to have gone a lot farther than that. Because I think it's kind of bizarre to expect the Russians did all the things they did. And we know now, for instance, that it was recently just came out in the New York Times that they actually were able to access election systems in all 50 states. That just came out in the last couple of weeks. So this is even that's even a worse picture than we realized even a few months ago. And I think it's you had a situation in Russia where you had multiple intelligence agencies. You had the GRU, the FSB, you had some other ones that were the SVR that were competing with one another to basically conduct covert operations overseas. And they all had their like boiler rooms of hackers, and they were attacking our elections and doing things. And I think it's just it's kind of crazy to expect that they would walk right up to the point of rigging election machines, but then not do so. I think it's just bizarre to think that they would stop. I mean, I think they almost, given the competitive pressures between these agencies and these boiler rooms of basically fairly young guys who were doing this hacking, that somehow they would walk up to that point and stop. Consider this. Let's say, because we know they got into the election systems of a lot of states, and we know a lot of people were turned away at the polls. We know a lot of people were turned away at the polls, and this is a suspicion that the poll rolls were purged. And we also know that they got into the machines of and computer systems of various voting machine manufacturers that programmed the machines. And we don't know what the code of these machines look like because it's proprietary software. So what we're being here's what we're being asked about to believe about the 2016 election and maybe even the 2018 election. We're being asked to believe it's like suppose someone breaks into your apartment. This is the metaphor I use. Suppose someone breaks into your apartment or your house. What happens? Do they walk around and look around and say, oh, this is cool. I'm in the house. I'm in the apartment. You know, this is cool. And then they turn around and they walk away. They don't tag your walls. They don't break your stuff. They don't steal anything. They don't even take a crap in the toilet or steal a beer out of the fridge. They just look around and say, oh, this is kind of fun. This is cool. And then they leave. Now, I think we all know as mature adults, that's just not going to happen. Your place is going to be trashed. Stuff is going to be missing. You know, it's not going to happen. Or alternative, let's say someone breaks into your car and they are able to start your car. Do they just sit there with the motor idling and they don't drive anywhere? And they just say, oh, this is cool. I got into the car. And they don't do anything with the car once they got into the car. I think we all know that if someone gets into your car and starts it, that you're going to find it in a bad neighborhood, missing half its parts and a burned out shell. That's what's going to happen. But this is sort of what we're being asked to believe, that they got into these election systems and they got into the systems of these voting machine manufacturers. And they sort of looked around and said, hey, this is cool. And then they left. Now, do we believe this? I, for one, I think it's an absurd thing to expect us to believe this. I don't think it happened. I think we don't know how far it went. We may never know how far it went. But even members of Congress, for instance, I was just reading the other day about Representative Jackie Speier of California, who was saying, you know, she believes the election was rigged. And I think we're seeing more and more people are looking at what happened in our elections, and they're saying, yeah, that you know, a lot of these things were rigged, and it's the legitimacy of a lot of our elections are really a doubt. And I think you're looking forward to 2020 to get back to your original question here. How do we know, you know, can we be really sure what happened? Now, I think we're kind of lucky here in New York State. Most New York communities, we use hand-marked paper ballots that are then optically scanned. It's very difficult to hack that. It could be done, but it's very difficult. You'd have to create a replacement set of ballots. We do need to spot check all those ballots and to make sure the machines are counting accurately. But I think New York would not be a target, particularly for hackers. But what about some of these other states, like in Pennsylvania, for instance, and some other states like Florida? They do use large numbers of what they call direct entry recording machines, or DREs. And basically you have a touch screen thing like an iPad, and you just mark on this whole thing, and it gets to the end, and you cast your vote. It's all electronic, and there's no paper trail. And in some cases, they have a machine like that where you have a touch screen, and you touch the screen like it would on, say, an iPad, and it goes through, and it prints you out a little paper ballot. But do people look at this, you know, basically it's a verification ballot. The ballot is recorded electronically, and it prints out a little tape, but you can look at it. But how many people are actually going to look at that tape in the first place? And in the second place, what is the actual ballot on that tape? Because when they print these little tapes out, there's a barcode on it. And then there's a thing that says of how you voted. And if it isn't what you voted for, you can sort of cancel that or stop the process. However, how do you know that the information that's encoded in the barcode matches the printout? This is a fundamental question. You actually have no way of knowing that the list of things that you supposedly voted for matches the barcode, which is the actual ballot. So, I mean, there are just huge numbers of issues with this, and there's a growing call that everyone should vote on a optically or a hand marked paper ballot, and we can scan them, or if we want to, we can manually count them all. I think it's worth noting that in Canada, for instance, right next door to us, they use hand marked paper ballots, and they count them in 2 hours on election night. Every precinct sits down, and they count the ballots, and they mark them, and they call it all in, and it takes 2 hours to count the whole country. They do it.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow, we're told, somehow we can't get it together here in the United States and do something similar, so we have absolute confidence in the security of our elections. Really, part of the problem, I think, is that people have come to think of war, in a sense, because we've heard so much about World War II and so on, we've come to think about war in very conventional sort of terms, more or less the Japanese come over and they bomb Pearl Harbor. The Germans come over and they fight with the RAF, this kind of thing. But war doesn't have to necessarily be that way. I know in my story in New York Station, the character realizes the Nazis are trying to rig the election. He says, well, why do you need tanks and planes if you can do that? It's all the same. Either way, you're taken over. And, you know, in a sense that I think that's sort of the issue we face today. And it's not just the United States that this is happening to. A lot of people are saying, oh, well, Putin just hated Hillary Clinton. Once Hillary Clinton went away, they weren't so interested. Well, no, that's not so. Now, they're doing this all over the world. They tried to do it in Ukraine. They're doing it. You know, a lot of people think the elections in Hungary were not right. Also in Turkey, there's questions about what happened in a whole lot of countries. The Brexit vote, the original Brexit vote in England, may have been a dry run or a trial run, so to speak, on the attack on elections in this country. There were questions about whether that actually was a straight election or not. So this is something that's going on all the world. And the Russians can get their goal even if they don't necessarily succeed. I mean, let's say Trump was legitimately elected, but the whole thing, he's put such a cloud over the democratic process. He's shaken our confidence in our own institutions. He's just generating a lot of chaos. Chaos alone can be a goal that's worthy for them. This was the case in 1940. I mean, did the Germans really expect to take over the United States? No, clearly they didn't expect to do that. They wanted to block Roosevelt, but they just wanted chaos. And what would have been served if Wilkie had been elected, that would have worked for them. Wilkie was a decent man. He was a good person. He actually was strongly anti-fascist. He was against Hitler. But, you know, the President of the United States didn't get sworn in 1940 until March, as opposed to January, where it is today.
Right.
You'd be starting out with a new, completely inexperienced president who had no political, no foreign policy experience. And Hitler would have had like another year or two while Wilkie got his feet on the ground and his team got his feet on the ground to do all the things that he was doing. So, you know, when you figure that, you know, the president would have been sworn in March, the Russians the Germans invaded the Soviet Union on June 22nd, which wasn't all that long later, you'd have had this long interregnum where nothing would have happened and Hitler would have had a free hand. That would have been great for him. So there are all kinds of objectives, and they don't necessarily even have to take over a country or put their people in power to achieve their objectives. And the Russians clearly do want to just undermine democracy and democratic institutions in general. And I think one of the reasons they want to do that is, in their case, if they can point to their own people and say, look, democracy is a failure, then they cement their own rule in more firmly and concretely than perhaps it would be otherwise. And there are a lot of people in Russia who are unhappy with it. And they've had big demonstrations in Russia against Putin in Moscow very recently. They arrested thousands of people. So they're insecure. This is an insecure regime. They know they're not legitimate. Putin probably cheated in his own elections a few years ago. So this is, you know, this is sort of the larger picture here. It's going on.
Okay, in the year 2000, you know, in the state of Florida, there was controversy, and you know, the totals between Gore and Bush were pretty close. And in Florida, Catherine Harris, who was the Secretary of State down there, she she was in the midst of all this stuff. So would you say in 2000, the Russians interfered with our election?
Oh, no, there's not much evidence that the Russians were involved in 2000. I think that coming out of the Yeltsin period, they were not. This is something that's happened in the last 15 or 20 years, not in 2000. Yes. There were weird questions about what happened in 2000. I mean, you know, after all, we have corruption in our own country, and we're, in a sense, there are corrupt elements here who can rig elections on their own. There were questions about, I think Catherine Harris was connected in with some, there were accusations connected, I think it was the Saudis, if memory serves me right, and so on. So there were weird aspects about what happened in Florida. You know, but at the same time, though, it has to be said that the Gore campaign, I think, mishandled it pretty badly. Excuse me.
Okay.
They were recommended. They had two sets of attorneys basically working for Gore. There were local attorneys in Tallahassee who knew the Florida system. Had actually written books on Florida elections and recommended that Florida that Gore demand all the votes in the state be recounted. And Gore was told by some national lawyers not to do that, and he went with them. And he should have listened to the local guys who actually knew the local lay of the land and the local laws, because the votes were there. And in fact, one of the weird things about the 9/11 attacks is there was a recount of all the ballots in the state that was being conducted by a series of newspapers, and they were clearly revealing that that Gore won, and this really alarmed the Bush administration, which is, you know, one of the reasons why they may have slept through the 9/11 attacks. So that is an accusation that's out there. I mean, it's one of those things that's impossible to prove probably at this point, but there's been a pall over all that for a long, long time.
Okay, in 2016, if what you're saying is accurate, is there a great possibility that Hillary Clinton could have won?
Well, I think clearly, first place, just to be clear on that, Hillary Clinton did win by 3 million votes in the popular vote. Trump won by 77,000 votes in three states. I think it's a myth that, I think it's a myth that you have to actually beat them all, you know, completely flip the entire country. You just have to reach in a few strategic places and flip those. If you can go into a few urban districts, for instance, like in Minneapolis or someplace like that, they're like heavily minority districts, and you can really suppress a vote, you can get those 70,000 votes. Or if you just, say, flip a few votes here and there, have the machines change the votes. Like every fifth vote for Hillary, you would, you know, incorrectly cast it as a Trump vote. This is something that happened really in the last election. There were weird things that happened in Texas, in Indiana, in Missouri, where the people had these direct entry machines, and one of the things that would happen is they would hit the button for straight Democratic, and they would look down and they would see that the Republican candidate was being listed with their other Democratic candidates. So Beto may have won, for instance, in Texas. McCaskill may have been reelected in Missouri. It was very weird. See, this is an example of how, you know, the machines can miscast. So if you go and people voted straight Democratic, but they were listening to the opposition candidate is one of the Republican candidates, or the Republican candidate is one of the Democrats. So how many votes were miscast there by people who didn't spot that on the screen of the machine?
Mm-hmm.
So there's there's a lot of reasons for concern and a lot of weird things that have happened that are very disturbing.
So what people who are listening to this, do you have any recommendations for them, what they should be looking for as the 2020 election is just around the corner?
If you live in a state that uses a direct entry machine, I think what you want to do is you want to vote absentee if you can. I think if everyone requested an absentee ballot, that's a paper ballot, basically, and they get hand counted.
Yeah.
You're guaranteed that your vote's going to be cast. So I think in a lot of these states, you know, there are literally millions of people who could vote, you know, because they start early voting now in a lot of states 2 weeks early. For instance, it was the case
mm-hmm.
of Florida. You may remember the big lines. Those people actually didn't have to go stand in line to vote early. They could have called up and just requested an absentee ballot. The Board of Elections would have sent them an absentee ballot, and they could have voted absentee. They didn't have to stand there in line. If you're really concerned about your vote being cast and you're in a precinct or a state where you have these direct entry machines that don't create a paper trail that you can audit, where your ballot is the actual ballot, you know, the paper thing printed out is the actual ballot and not being recorded electronically, vote absentee. You can do that. Then I think, and people need to call their local boards of election and local county boards and state boards and demand that these machines be replaced immediately. If they can't get enough machines in there, just give everybody a paper ballot. There's no reason why everybody can't vote with a paper ballot.
But with a paper ballot, if everybody requested one and all of them were sent back to the Board of Elections, I live in Albany, and there's been, you know, kind of rumors about paper ballots being missing and so forth. So what I'm saying is you might vote on a paper ballot, but there's no telling from what I think is that they will be counted on the up and up.
Well, you have in almost everywhere, you have generally a Democratic election inspector and commissioner and a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And basically you have to rely on your Democratic or Republican commissioners, respectively, depending on how you see it, to be doing their jobs fundamentally. Obviously,
okay.
If they get a lot of ballots in, they're going to have a management problem, but they'll have to get extra people in and do it, get them counted.
Okay, so now it seems as though Trump and Putin have a pretty cozy, you know, buddy-buddy relationship.
Oh, yeah.
Do you think that Putin wants Trump for a second term? And if so, what do you think the ramifications of that will be for our country?
Well, yes, I think he clearly does, because I think, for one thing, Trump is, at the very minimum, giving him the chaos that he wants. I mean, I don't think they necessarily see Trump Trump doesn't have to be carrying out their agenda. He can just be making a mess of everything, and that works for Russia. I mean, but he is blowing up our treaty, system of treaty alliance that's kept the peace since World War II. He is just creating chaos in trade, and, you know, that's going to do, like, real damage to our economy down the road. He's doing
mm-hmm.
a lot of things that Putin likes. Is Putin calling the shots on all that? We don't know. It's possible, but it doesn't have to be. You know, he can just be a chaos agent. I mean, look at it from the Russian point of view. I mean, they had to know, with all of Trump's bankruptcies and so on, that what kind of a sort of bumbler, incompetent bumbler he really is. I mean, he actually inherited an enormous fortune. And managed to lose, and apparently is being floated by the Russians over the years because they saw him as a very useful sort of tool. He doesn't actually have to be carrying out their agenda as long as he just generates chaos, and God knows he's generated chaos. I mean, would you, for instance, like a lot of people think, well, are asking, well, did Trump collude with Putin in the election. He doesn't have to. It wasn't necessary. It's missing the point. I mean, basically, he was just a torpedo sent in to disrupt the United States and cause chaos. He doesn't have to be actually working in concert with Putin to be a legitimate president. All he has to be is a useful idiot, as Lenin said. And in a sense, that's you know, in a way, if he was a useful idiot, that's exactly the way he's behaved. I mean, he's just generating enormous chaos. I mean, look at the racial hatred that he's whipping up. And I think let's think about that for a minute, for instance. I think it's a huge interesting thing that's going on right now. And with these two shootings that just occurred, I mean, everyone is upset. And they're horrible. And Trump is out there, and he gave this half-hearted speech this morning, which he misread off the teleprompter, and even got the city where one of the shootings wrong. He said one of them was in Toledo, which is kind of incredible, not Dayton, you know. But some people think he's senile, and that's possible. Yeah, but looking at the bigger picture, if you were the Russians, would you trust this man with confidential information? Would you trust his children, all these the collection of incompetent people around him, that you would collude with them and confide with them? I wouldn't. I mean, I think, but that doesn't mean he can't be a useful tool for the Russians and their purposes. They sort of set him in there, like throwing a monkey wrench in the gears, and that's sort of what he is. He doesn't have to, Trump didn't have to collude with Putin to be an illegitimate president or to just cause damage and chaos to our country.
Okay, so if Russia wants to disrupt elections all over the world, you know, like the United States and Europe and so forth, and they're hanging on by a thread in Russia, what's the ultimate game plan for Putin to cause such disruption all over the world?
Well, I think it's basically by if they want to destroy alternatives. They want to destroy alternatives to the kind of rule they have. They don't want their corruption to be exposed. Russia's a very corrupt country. I mean, the country has been looted. In a way, you can't blame the average people there, for average person, for being angry. I mean, for instance, there's enormous oil wealth that came out of Russia. It's a major oil producer. It's clear most of that money has been stolen. The average standard of living of the average Russian has gone down since the end of the Soviet Union in most cases. There's an elite that's, you know, it's in the cities like Moscow and St. Petersburg that are doing incredibly well. But the countryside, in a lot of ways, has been devastated. Millions of people lost their jobs and livelihood. They lost their pensions. They lost everything, basically. And they're having an incredibly hard time. Here's an interesting statistic I found a little while ago that, Mexico, Russia's got a population around 130, 140 million. Mexico is closing in on Russia in terms of population. And not only are they closing in on Russia in terms of population, but they're closing in on Russia in terms of its gross domestic product. Now, what happens, what's the state of the world when Mexico is a more populous country than Russia and has a bigger GDP? Which is probably going to happen. Russia is a third world country with ballistic missiles, basically. So how does that regime survive? Well, they've got to destroy alternatives to their regime. And if they can discredit democracy, and the Chinese want to do this too, by the way, you know, they're not at the moment intervening in elections as far as anyone knows, although they are engaging in all the kinds of like industrial espionage on a massive scale. But you know, by destroying alternatives to their rule, they cement themselves into power. So that's what they've got something to get out of this. It's worth it for them to be doing this. And these are cheap programs. I mean, they can't go toe to toe with Russia, at any rate, can't go toe to toe with the United States in military power anymore. Their fleet, for instance, is aging. A lot of their navy was built during the Soviet period, and it's aging out. And they're going to have to scrap a lot of it, and it'll probably shrink. They are building new missile submarines, but you know, in a lot of ways, it's a very weak country. But you know, if they can destroy an alternative to their rule, they can be there forever. So this sort of all works for them.
Well, so do you think he's more dangerous than the Soviet system and the czars before that?
Yes, I mean, he's actually. This is the amazing thing about it. I mean, although there's an incredible continuity from the Tsars to the Soviets to Putin, but in terms of Russian policy, but I think in a lot of ways. I mean, there was never any danger that the communists would take over the United States or most of Western Europe. There was a short period after World War II, there was a little shakiness in Europe, but you know, we basically propped that up pretty quickly with the Marshall Plan, and that threat just died. It very quickly became apparent that no one would want to live under communism and could live in a free society. So that was not really a great long-term threat. The threat was an external military threat that the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact posed. There was never any danger the United States would become a communist country. But here, if they're destroying our elections, they've actually accomplished something that the Soviet regime was never able to accomplish. And they're doing it all the world. So in a lot of ways, they are more successful. And that's what's fascinating about it in a lot of ways is there is a tremendous continuity from the Tsars to the Soviet regime to the present. I mean, Putin was a KGB officer. He used to check what they call the Czechist. The Czechist was the old Tsarist secret police. And they allowed people transition from the Cheka under the Tsars to the Soviet regime, and then they transitioned from the Soviet regime to the modern Putin Czechist system. Here's an interesting story on this. It's known because when the German Democratic Republic, East Germany, collapsed, the records of the Stasi fell into the hands of the West German government. And we know that the East German Stasi, the secret police in Eastern Germany, had a plan, basically, to devolve communism. And what the Stasi wanted to do is the people in the Stasi knew communism was a failure, it wasn't going to survive. And they had a plan in the Stasi, basically, to create a post-communist, pseudo-capitalist sort of state, where East Germany would remain a separate country and supposedly it would become a capitalist regime, but would actually still remain under the control of the Stasi. And there's good reason to believe that a whole bunch of secret police agencies in other Eastern European countries, Warsaw Pact countries, had similar plans. Like, for instance, in Romania, that thought they had a similar sort of plan. They knew communism was going to go down, but they were going to retain their power, and they were going to transition the Stasi from basically a communism to capitalism and maintain secret police and maintain themselves in power. And that failed because East Germany just suddenly collapsed. So we know about that. But it does appear that, in the case of Putin, that they transitioned, they pulled that off successfully. There was a brief period under Yeltsin where they had a sort of pseudo-democratic sort of system, and then that collapsed, basically, because the country was just in such chaos. And we were partially responsible for that, the economic policies we advocated. But they, the Cheka, the secret police, wound up in control of the country. And we had this sort of pseudo-capitalist regime that's actually a kleptocracy that's looting the country, and Stasi's sitting on top, and they're all getting rich. And that's sort of what happened.
Wow. So, as we approach the 2000 election, I'm sure there's going to be a lot more to be discussed. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, God, yeah. I think we have to be alert, and we have to demand clean elections. We have to demand things like paper ballots that are hand-marked and properly scanned and with audits and so on, and just be sure that we know how we're voting. And I do think that, I think there's a real cloud over the Trump presidency. And to step back for a look at the bigger picture here for a minute, why is Trump making all these – he's sort of ginning up the race hatred in a big way right now.
Right.
And he's inciting these attacks, and it's what's technically known as stochastic terrorism. That is to say, you incite other people to create acts that are statistically likely, but are individually can't be attributed to any particular cause. So why are they doing this? And I think there was something really important that came out of the Mueller hearings. A lot of people were disappointed to them, but I think that was wrong. There was a early rush for judgment out of the Mueller testimony. I think it was, like so many things, was often wrong. And something really big came out of that, and that was the revelation that there were still ongoing counterintelligence investigations going on. Trump knows this. Obviously, the Pelosi and the Democrats in Congress know this. And I think what's going on here is he's trying to distract people from the bigger story of what's really going on here that really has them scared. Trump is not stupid. He isn't. He's intellectually incurious. He certainly doesn't think analytically. But he's got a good political gut. And he just goes on instinct. And his instincts are let's just throw a lot of dust up in the air and distract the hell out of people. And you know what? He's doing a great job. Do you hear anybody talking about Mueller and the Russians anymore?
Mm-hmm.
No, everyone's upset about his racial attacks and what he's doing to the country and the violence that he's screwing up. And, you know, well, that works for him again, just like sort of the things that Putin is doing. He's got everybody talking about all this. And in a sense, we should be. But in a sense, the eye is we're not watching some larger long-term issues because it gets drowned out by all this other stuff. So there's a certain method to the madness here of what's going on. And I just hope that people can pick up the thread of this when this recent crisis is over. Although, obviously, the crisis in gun violence isn't going to go away anytime soon, probably. Awful as that is.
As events leading up to the 2000 election and maybe even beyond, I'd love to have you back on my podcast.
Thank you.
Talk from your perspective, what's going on. I think you could be very enlightening to people. So listening, Lawrence Dudley. Are you writing anything else now?
Yes, actually, I have a sequel to New York Station. It's coming out in January. I'm going to have a book event at the North Shore Bookstore in January. You want to watch for that. We're going to have a book launch, and that's the title is The Hungry Blade, and it picks up the adventures of Roy Hawkins and carries on. He goes to Mexico in the story, fights the Nazis there.
Okay. Maybe you could come down to the bookhouse in Albany.
I'd love to. I have never been invited, but I certainly would love to be invited, yes. That'd be great.
So you're listening to Larry Dudley, and if you like this show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes, leave a comment about this show, hashtag Focus on Albany. Larry, I look forward to talking with you again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.